We may live in tumultuous times now, but many of us certainly have lived through such times before, like the protest and even riot-filled years of the late 60s and early 70s. Those were the years of major social change in America, or at least the possibility of major social change. The women's movement flowered in those years. Today's guest was there, and she shares her experiences with us, albeit in fictionalized form, in her novel. It is called Take Me to Mercy, How the Cary Nation Changed My Life. Kathy Olson is the author. She lives in Jacksonville, and she's a nonprofit consultant and trainer, the founder of Kathy Olson Consults. She spent 3 decades plus as a board member, executive director, or fundraiser for nonprofit groups, helping to raise more than $2 million over the course of her career. Kathy Olson joined us a year ago to talk about her mom, also an author, also an activist, Tilly Olson, and it's good to have you back on The Exchange.
Thank you.
So tell us about the book itself, Take Me to Mercy, How the Cary Nation Changed My Life. The title alone takes a little explaining.
It does. Those of you who know Reading, and this is loosely modeled after the town of Reading and takes place in a town a lot like Reading, know the Mercy Hospital. And there was a time when there was a competition between the two hospitals in town, and there were bumper stickers that said, Take Me to Mercy. And I loved that, the various meanings of that, and I held it close to me. The expression that how the Cary Nation changed my life is a reference to a group that really did exist. It was a women's group that started in Reading in 1970. And it was, the title came from, of course, the wonderful Women's Christian Temperance Union activist who, of the 1800s, who went around smashing up bars with her axe. And it was a play on words from the Indian Nation and all of those other things that were being bandied about at the time. And we thought we would, for fun, call ourselves the Cary Nation. Part of that was an attempt at making people know that this was not a dreadful movement. This was a marvelous movement and full of humor and love and light as much as anything else.
You really were ahead of your time, because there are so many people who use the term nation now for, you know, the Stephen Colbert Nation, the Beaver Nation, the Red Sox Nation, et cetera. So.
Well, we were the Cary Nation.
All right.
So I wrote this book because it is not autobiography. It is fictionalized. And I have spent a lot of the last few years apologizing to lots of people for taking their stories and twisting them up so that they would make better fiction.
And they should have been unrecognizable by that point, but they got recognized.
Well, they knew who they were, but they are pretty unrecognizable. People are not going to find their mother in this book. Or if they do, they won't know that that's who it is. But I wanted to tell the story because I felt that, first off, the word feminism had gotten a bad rap. And that people didn't understand, A, where we were then and how far we have come to now. And also they didn't understand why we made the progress we did. And I also thought that they also didn't see how much had not yet changed and how much still had to be done. And I wanted to give the young people some hope that they can, in fact, get together and make change. So how to do that? I thought, I'll fictionalize the story. I'll make it a light read. This is not fancy literature. This is not a heavy-duty tome. It is light. You can read it in about 2 days at the most, and it's a beach read. It's meant to be fun. It's a love story as much as anything else. A love story. It's a coming-of-age story of a young woman flees the big city, wants to go live in the country, and leaves behind a disastrous love affair, and finds in the beautiful country of Northern California peace and solace, and then this wonderful community of women. And ultimately, she also finds her husband. And I won't tell you the end of the story, but that's what the story's about.
I deliberately didn't get to the back of the book because I don't want to blow it for the people who might want to read it. Did you ever think about telling the story of that time, though, as a nonfiction book? I mean, your mother was famous for her writing as well and her activism and the ways that she put people out there in the world and
I
reality.
I did, but I think it's more fun. Here's a confession. I'm somebody who spends a lot of my time reading murder mysteries and lighter fare, if you will, and I wanted it to be a book that maybe people might actually read, and I thought if I wrote a nonfiction historical book, you might possibly, if I were really lucky, get read in one class somewhere in the country. And I didn't want that. I want it to be fun. I want it to be readable. So I said, let's pretty it up and make it fun.
Did you feel like you got swept up in the political movements of the time?
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I got it with my mother's milk, if you will. Mm-hmm. I was raised in an activist family. And, you know, that was such a rich time from the civil rights movement of the late 1950s and the early 1960s, how all across every discipline, things sort of exploded. Everybody started examining everything. Things that had been true all through, ever since World War II, suddenly were up for grabs and discussion. Anything from psychology, do we still think that Freud understood women? I don't think so, we said. Anyway, that's how it started.
So we questioned authority, we questioned assumptions. Everything was under question.
Everything was
right.
Under
assumptions. Much more to talk about with Kathy Olson. She is writing about the late 60s, early 70s in her book, Take Me to Mercy, How the Carrie Nation Changed My Life. It is a novel, but there are lots of notes we can compare on that period in history. And feel free to join us on The Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Kathy and take your phone calls and emails as well when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Kathy Olson, activist, author, fundraiser. She's done a lot of things in her life. She now lives in Jacksonville, and her latest book is called Take Me to Mercy, How the Carrie Nation Changed My Life, a fictionalized account of finding yourself, or finding herself in the case of the narrator, in Northern California in the early 70s in the blossoming of the women's movement, which is a time period some of us can probably relate to. Join us to talk about that aspect of life and the time in our history and in your life as well. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. So as we were setting this up, talking about the Carrie Nation is the name of the group, the women's group that formed in the fictional Delta Springs, California, in this book, which is loosely based on Reading. But you talk about one of the reasons that you wanted to write the book was you feel like feminism has gotten a bad rap. Mm-hmm. From whom, for what?
Oh, I don't know if I want to analyze from whom or even for what.
Don't ever say Rush Limbaugh? Feminazis?
We could say those things. I'm trying to be polite here. I think that there's a lack of understanding of what it was about. First off, people think that the feminist movement came from academic women on campuses, women of privilege, women of money, who were talking about having a choice, when in fact most of us women didn't have a choice. We worked because we had to work, and that's still true. And so there's some resentment and lack of understanding about who the women's movement really was. It's part of the purpose of this book. The women's movement I knew was a women's movement of ordinary women, working women, mothers, housewives, all kinds of women, who were trying to figure out why it was that things were so darn difficult for them. And learning to trust each other was a big deal. We'd been raised to not trust each other. We trusted men. Men were the leaders. Men were the wise ones. Women were portrayed as, you know, the gossipy ones who turned on each other. In fact, we had to learn to have the ability to trust each other before we could trust ourselves. We had to ask the big questions because they weren't being asked. Why weren't there women in the museums, for example? Is it because women couldn't do great art, or was it because they didn't have a chance? And if they didn't have a chance, what the heck could we do about that to change it? Here in our own Rogue Valley at Rogue Community College in 1971, there was a protest. A group of the women faculty and staff got together, and they wanted to know why it was that they were paid 60% of what men doing the same work they were doing was paid. That was the truth then. And they were told, please go home, you guys, just calm down. The reason is because men have families to support. Well, excuse me, those of us who know anything about reality know that most women who work because they have to. They have to support their families. And also, a lot of families are headed by women. They don't have any men in their family to help them. That was a truism. In also the same year, and let's take Palo Alto. Let's go down to California, which was supposedly so progressive. In Palo Alto, there were 26 schools. That's 26 school principals, right? And 6 assistant principals. Only one was a woman in 1970. These are terrible statistics. And as we looked around, we thought, why is that? Why is that? Is that because we're incapable? No, we knew we were capable. We knew how much work we did that backed up the men who stood in the front. And breaking through took solidarity, it took courage, and it took the courage of ordinary women. Some of the women went into the trade union movement and organized in that way, but other women just did it by supporting each other, by asking the big questions. The men thought these women's groups were talking about them. We weren't going together to talk about our husbands or our fathers or our sons or our brothers. We were talking about the big issues from which we had been excluded for so long. We were talking about economics. We were talking about medicine. We were talking about ecology. We were talking about a lot of things that we had been excluded from.
And these are not questions that were getting asked nearly as much 10 years before, but there were some pioneering women who put it out there, and it empowered or emboldened people like, ordinary people by 1970, which is the setting for the first year of the book.
That's right. 1963, Betty Friedan published this book called The Feminine Mystique. And to everybody's astonishment, it became a national bestseller overnight. It exploded. And what it talked about was things like women who went through college with great hope and creativity and heart and intelligence, and then what they were really expected to do was to get married by the time they graduated and have babies and stay home and be quiet. She talked about the frustration of that and the loss to society, because if you lose half the brain power of your country, this is not a good thing.
No. They're home changing diapers when they really could be other things.
That's right. But I want to tell you the other things that the young women don't know. When I was in high school, there were no sports for girls. There were no intramural sports for girls at all. A few wealthier school districts may have had tennis, but that was it. Maybe swimming, that was it.
This is all pre-Title IX.
This is all pre-Title IX. And finally, we got Title IX. Title IX said you can't discriminate based on gender, that all students had to be given the same opportunities. And what happened in the world of sport was an explosion of women saying, yeehaw, finally I can go out and kick a ball and play basketball or do whatever it is that I want to do. It still took the courage of individual women, Billie Jean King in tennis. You can go down a list of pioneers who helped. But it took this incredible wave of millions of ordinary women all over the country saying, yes, that's what we need. That's what we want to make it happen.
Kathy Olson is our guest. The novel is Take Me to Mercy. The setting is 1970 and the women's movement. And here is Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. Among other things, there was a group called the Carrie Nations, a fictional rock band in the film Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
Oh, how great.
And something else, in the early days of the women's movement, the FBI found it difficult to infiltrate them because they didn't allow adult males in, and they didn't have any female agents, or if they did, they didn't have enough to to cover the need. I happen to have worked with women in the National Organization for Women, which the paper of the town I was living in at the time almost invariably referred to as the National Organization of Women, which would make them very angry.
Right.
And then they would also refer to the state director, whom I knew very slightly, as he.
Hmm.
And she, of course, would take great umbrage at this. But as for progress, I know a woman here in Reading who tried to live out in the country, and every time she would leave, the people who lived around her, apparently, nobody knows exactly who it was, would vandalize her home.
Really?
Or she was gone for any length of time. So she ended up moving back into town.
Okay. Thanks for that, Mark. Appreciate it. Anything like that happened I assume you lived somewhere in the Reading area.
Well, I did, yes. But I want to talk about the people in the book. The main character, Joe, she, in fact, moves to Reading with a married couple, friends of hers, old friends of hers.
Delta Springs, California, is known in the book.
Well, yes, it's known as Delta Springs. We don't call it Reading because it isn't exactly Reading. And they end up buying a ranch up 40 miles east of Reading, up in the mountains. And like a lot of young people of that time, wanting to find out about living on the land, growing their own food, finding a way to find peace and quiet after work. And Joe learns a lot about country life. It's not so simple, is it? It's a lot of work. It's a lot of slogging, hard work. And she loves it, and she has a great time. She ends up having to leave for a lot of reasons, which you have to read the book to find out. But it is hard for a woman to be alone in the country. There's no question. It's hard for anybody to be alone in the country. We do have women, though, who do that and do it quite successfully and quite beautifully, and I'm grateful to them.
Kathy Olson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a Rogue Valley resident and author of the novel Take Me to Mercy, How the Cary Nation Changed My Life. It's a fictionalized account of the early 1970s in a fictionalized version of Reading. Talking about the women's movement and the activism of the times. Kathy's mother, of course, the activist and author herself, Tilly Olson. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 around the region. 541-552-6782. Feel free to share memories of movements that you were in around 1970 as well. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. So we figured out the setting and some of the characters. Joe, Jennifer, and Dick are the main characters here. Jennifer is Joe's longtime friend, and Dick is Jennifer's husband.
That's correct.
What's the plot then? How do you advance things in the book? What's the general driving thrust here?
They buy this ranch. Meanwhile, they are working for the early days of the War on Poverty. It was called the Community Action Program. The War on Poverty was, for those of you who don't know, President Johnson's attempt to help solve poverty. It was actually an incredible movement that included everything from legal services to Planned Parenthood to food banks, economic development activities. There were a lot of things that came in under that umbrella. And this is also a story about that. It's also what happens is her work is central to her, like most of us. Where do we spend the bulk of our week? We spend it at work. And this is a story about women's work. She works as a legal secretary. She works as an accountant. She then goes to work for legal services and becomes a paralegal and an office manager. Meanwhile, she and Jennifer are organizing the Cary Nation. And you get to know all of the characters in the book, in the Cary Nation, in different ways. I tried to tell the stories of different women's experience by telling the stories of different women. These are combinations of real women. There's no real person's story in this book, but every one of these things resonates. There is the older woman coming to grips with aging and with her children leaving. There's another woman who has a heart attack, and the hospital in those days, they were not equipped to understand how women's heart attacks showed themselves because they weren't studying women's bodies. They were only studying men's bodies. She is misdiagnosed, and we talk about that in the book. Another woman, her husband gets a terrible illness, and he's dying, and she's facing becoming a single mother and facing the fact that she was not happy being a housewife and she didn't know she wanted to be an artist, but here she is tending to a dying husband. Meanwhile, Joe finds her love of her life, and it's a love story. It tells the story of them and them falling in love and learning all of those things you have to learn when you're first together. She has to learn how to cook. She has to learn how to clean a sink. She has to learn a lot of things. Joe has to learn a lot of things. The group, when they start, the town kind of goes a little crazy. The local newspaper has a editorial called, "The Libbers Are Coming, The Libbers Are Coming." And everybody gets excited, and all of the various service clubs in town who are always looking for somebody new to come and talk, they invite the Cary Nation to come and talk. And can I read a little bit?
Absolutely.
Do I have time to read a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
So,
Need the headphones if you want to keep it up a hand.
Thank you. Yeah, they're having a hard time here. They get invited to talk, and we decide in the Cary Nation to send a woman named Eleanor. Eleanor is 6 feet tall. She's brilliant. She's married to an attorney in town who is very well respected. And we figure that she's funny and she's smart, and we can send her. During the first presentation, Eleanor is politely welcomed and fed a lunch of beef stew. Introduced as the barrister's wife, she speaks for 10 minutes eloquently about inequities in pay and the need for women to fulfill their potential, even if that potential was for something not recognized as female. She spoke of the need to expand all knowledge to include women, using the example that you can't just have a universal psychology developed only by, for, and of men, and then expect it to work for women. She was funny and touching and profound, and she held the assembled animals in thrall. Some of the smirks were actually replaced with serious faces. When she was finished, she leaned her 6-foot-tall frame over the podium and asked for questions. From the owner of a local plywood plant, "Mrs. Tompkins, how can you expect an employer to pay as much to a woman who will probably leave to have babies as they do to a man who has a family to support?" "Well, sir, don't you believe that you should pay someone based on the value they give to your business? And besides, how do you know that the woman will leave? Don't most women in this community have to work?" From the owner of a trucking company, "Mrs. Tompkins, do you really believe that women can drive trucks, pilot airplanes, keep the peace?" Eleanor, "I don't know if all women can, but for that matter, we know that not all men can either. All I'm saying is that if a woman has the capacity, why not give her a chance?" This last comment really irritated one fellow, a skinny little accountant with a plastic pocket protector. Jumping to his feet, distaste dripping from his mouth, he demanded, "Mrs. Tompkins, you've got to admit that you women are the physically weaker sex." Mrs. Tompkins, with pure honey in her voice, leaned still farther over the podium and, to the roaring delight of all, looked down at the poor little fellow and responded, "Well, sweetie, let's test your theory. You want to arm wrestle?"
A passage from Take Me to Mercy, How the Carry Nation Changed My Life, Kathy Olsen's novel of the blossoming of the women's movement and the involvement of her characters in that around 1970. Join us on The Exchange. You might have some notes to compare about that time in history. 800-838-3760 around the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. And by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Ginger and Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, Kathy, I love that last passage. That was so funny. That was just great. Thank you for writing this book.
Thank you.
My question is, I joined a group in the early 80s, and I found it, for the first time in my life, to be a group that was inclusive. It welcomed anyone, and the goal of the group was to make sure that everyone's opinion or point of view was heard and understood. And I'm wondering if your book addresses that perspective from, you know, this women's group movement.
Absolutely it does. Ginger, thank you. I'm glad you were able to have that experience. One of the beauties of the women's movement and one of the things that I think helped change the content of the discussion for everybody in this country was the way that we learned to talk to each other. From the book, it says, "The guidelines seemed pretty simple. Everybody had to agree to speak one at a time and really listen to each other. Everybody had to agree to never repeat anything that was said to anybody outside of the meeting. Everybody had to give each other space to speak, meaning we weren't to rush each other, nor was anybody to dominate a discussion unless everybody agreed that it was okay. We had to agree to try not to judge each other." It was an exotic set of rules compared to Robert's rules of order. And that's true. The other thing is that in the Carry Nation and in the group that I actually participated in, we embraced difference. It was okay for us to be different. We didn't all have to be Democrats. We didn't all have to be Republicans. We even could have personal animosities between us. It was okay. We were there to support each other, to explore things, and you can't really explore things if you don't have difference, and we embrace that difference.
And given the time and place, you would have had some collisions of lifestyle, of country versus city, of
Absolutely.
Old guard versus new guard.
Absolutely. We had the Birkenstocks and we had the cowboy boots right there in the room.
What was the name of the actual group, the one upon which the Carry Nation of the novel is based?
It was called the Carry Nation.
It was, okay.
It was. This is my tribute to them, and actually at the back of the book, I thank those women.
By name.
By name.
All right. We'll talk more with Kathy Olson about Take Me to Mercy, how the Carrie Nation changed my life, the Carrie Nation, the women's group in real life that she belonged to. Her fictional character belongs to a group by the same name in the fictional Delta Springs, which is based loosely on Reading. Back on the Jefferson Exchange to talk about the early 70s and the women's movement and so much more with Kathy Olson and with you. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we return in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Jacksonville's own Kathy Olson. She is an author, a former activist. Well, I guess you're never former, are you? You're always an activist. Okay. Also a nonprofit consultant and trainer, the founder of Kathy Olson Consults. She's written a book called Take Me to Mercy, How the Carrie Nation Changed My Life. Take Me to Mercy, as in Take Me to Mercy Hospital. Carrie Nation, the name of a women's group that really did exist in Reading in the early 70s. Reading is fictionalized as Delta Springs, California, in the book. We're talking about the 1970s and the women's movement and the things we got out of that. Join us with that perspective on the Exchange. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. I want to talk about some of the characters in the fictionalized account. You already talked about, early in the book, you apologize for your outrageous toying with the truth.
Yes.
And supposedly have twisted up the characters in ways they won't be recognized.
But, one hopes.
But they do seem to recognize themselves. But some of the descriptions are just so good. Like, tell us about that Butt Ugly Ricky.
Oh, there's a lot of funny characters in this book. There's Butt Ugly Ricky, who is the head of the Community Action Program, and who, in spite of being butt ugly, thinks he's God's gift to women. He's the kind of guy who comes up and puts his hand on your shoulder and leans in a little bit too close and looks you straight in the eye and says, "How are you?" You know those guys. Sometimes their other hand's trying to find the stray down to your bottom. There's wonderful Connor, who is kind of a monosyllabic hippie who lives by himself out in the countryside, drives a great big beautiful Harley, and pretends that he's poor as a church mouse. But until you look closely, you see, wait a minute, that's a really beautiful Harley, and he's got a really beautiful sound system, a very expensive sound system, and he eats pretty darn well, and his beer is the best. There's a whole lot of great funny characters in this book. I tried, as I said, to keep it funny. The ones that aren't funny are the women. I really wanted you to see whole, real women, not cartoon women. And I apologize to the men if I made them cartoons. There's also the handsome sweetheart that Joe meets, with his beautiful blue eyes and his high cheekbones. And there's Tucker, who is a good old boy from the South. He's a great big tall man, wears his suspenders, and calls everybody bro in spite of the fact that he's as white as he could be. He's a very embarrassing man, but a wonderful man who organizes the world. There's a lot of good characters. Read my book. You'll like it.
You mentioned wanting to keep this a lighter read, a beach read kind of thing.
Yes.
I mean, for that reason, do the characters have a few less wrinkles and depths to them?
Absolutely.
Particularly the police chief chewing on
I love the police chief. Yeah, there's a demonstration in the book by a group of welfare mothers who aren't really sure what it is they're protesting other than being treated badly. They're just tired of it. And I call that chapter Marching to Peanut Butter, because they bring peanut butter and jelly sandwiches to the demonstration so the little kids who are there have something to eat. And they all march in, and the police chief is a riot. He thinks the whole thing is hysterically funny. And at the end of that chapter, of course, he tells the ladies, "Now, ladies, please do go home. I do not want to have to arrest you, but you know that I will. I will." He's a good guy, though. You'll like this sheriff. What else can I tell you?
Hairdo Woman is
hairdo. You
she's a
hear?
Bit of a caricature, but let's talk about Hairdo Woman just a bit.
Well, I didn't read you about this. Okay, let me read you about Hairdo Woman. When Joe and Jennifer and Dick are looking for a place to live, they've been living in a cheap concrete motel with rusty sinks, and the reason they're doing that is they have a litter of puppies and a dog with them, and they're having a hard time finding a place to rent. Anyway, they decide to go and look for a place to purchase, and they need a realtor. So Joe and Jennifer decide they want a woman realtor, and they find three only in the book. The rest of them are all men, and they call her, and they go to see her. Here's what it says. We enter a tiny real estate office facing a vision. The tall woman at the desk swirled her chair around to face us, giving us full view of more than might be considered prudent. She had an impressively huge bosom encased in a cheap red blazer that sported big gold buttons, only slightly tarnished. Her girdled hips were wrapped in a tight blue skirt, which was much too short for her ham-sized thighs. She had on piles of makeup, blue eyelids, big red mouth, red circles of blush on each worn-out cheek. She had tweezed and penciled her eyebrows into upside-down V's on her wrinkly forehead. All that geometric color didn't help her look any younger. Her hair was a carefully fluffed and constructed edifice that stood as high again as her face. That sucker had so much spray that it wouldn't blow a wisp in a hurricane. A cigarette dangled out of her mouth as she stuck out her blood-red-tipped hand and slowly drawled, "Howdy, what can I do for you girls?"
That's the description of a hairdo woman when she is first encountered by Joe and Jennifer in the book Take Me to Mercy, How the Carrie Nation Changed My Life, a work of fiction by Kathy Olson, but very much based on the flowering of the women's movement in the early 1970s. And we'll take some calls about that on the exchange. Here is Ellen in the Applegate. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Kathy Olson. Ellen, go ahead. Okay, people keep listening on the radio. You can't listen on the radio when you are on hold because it's 10 seconds off from the real world. So that's, I think, what happened there. Let's go to Siegel in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Kathy Olson.
Hi. Kathy, this is Siegel, and I just want to tell you, I am a woman who is of your generation but was not involved in the women's movement in an active way. And I want to thank you for writing this book because it gave me a lot of insight into the thoughts and ways that other women at that time lived, and I don't think that I even realized some of the things that I, the privileges that I didn't have, or the things that may have been a slight to me, and I wasn't even conscious of that. So I, even in spite of the fact of having gone to school in Berkeley, so I want to thank you for making this available not only to younger women, but even to women who are your peers.
All right. Faye Gale, sorry for mangling your name, but thanks so much for calling about that. And I mean, you probably are getting other responses like this as you trot the book around from people saying, "Oh, my God, I remember this time."
Every time I do any kind of public thing about it, I end up being very quiet and just listening to people tell their story. But I don't want us to believe that this is all just dead history. We still have places where women are suffering terribly. The issue of domestic violence is still front and center. We still have the same prejudices around that we had before. What we've done is we've been able to change some of the institutional practices and change them well, and I'm really proud of that, and I'm really grateful for that. But the personal prejudices still exist. We still have places that will not hire women, that will not, you still go to meetings where women are not listened to. We still don't have the affordable child care that working mothers desperately need. Most working mothers still come home and have to cook dinner and do the laundry and everything else. They're not going to sit down and put up their Tootsies and have a beer. They've still got full-time work ahead of them. Those things have not been solved. And if you're a woman of color, it's even worse. The statistics right now are kind of terrifying. And in this country, there are things that are, in my mind, quite horrible and unforgivable. The United States ranks below Bosnia, Croatia, Lithuania, Serbia, Guam, Northern Mariana Islands, and other industrialized countries in the rates of infant mortality. We are higher than 46 other countries. The number of preterm births has risen 20% from 1990 to 2011. We now rank 60th for maternal deaths on a list of 180 countries. We're just one of 8 countries to have seen a rise in maternal mortality over the past decade. The others are Afghanistan and Greece and several countries in Africa and Central America. I can go on with statistics like this. We have not won the battle. We're still seeing women suffer because they are women, and that's not okay.
Particularly on matters that seem like they were simple and dealt with long ago, the fact that we're still having, in this time in our history, talking about the differences in pay for men and women.
It's ridiculous.
When we're talking about people talking about this 45 years ago in the setting of your book.
In Oregon, Oregon ranks 17th among the states of the United States for economic security for women. Women overall earn only 79 cents for every dollar earned by a man. For women of color, the figures are even worse. Overall, 16.3% of U.S. women live in poverty, and in Oregon, 17.7% of all women live in poverty. And if you're Hispanic or Native American or African American, the figures are even worse. This is Oregon we're talking about.
Let's take some more calls. We're going to try again with Ellen in the Applegate. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Kathy Olson.
Hi. I have read the book, Kathy, and thoroughly enjoyed it. My question has to do with whether you've had an opportunity to talk to any younger women. I could relate to the experiences described in the book. Well, what about younger women? Have they talked about their own kinds of experiences, or does this maybe not happen anymore for young people?
It certainly happens to younger people. Thanks, Ellen, and thanks for the nice comment. First off, they're amazed at what has changed. What do you mean there was no sports for girls? What are you talking? I mean, they don't get it. It's yeah. Like, really? Is that true? Right now, the number of women in law school, the number of women in medical school, all of those things are their great statistics. And so women do indeed now have choices they didn't have when we were younger, and they're kind of astonished to hear that they didn't have it. They also, though, still talk about date rape. They still talk about all of those things that they're grappling with, that we had to grapple with, and they're astonished that we had to. Right now, one of the groups that I have had the privilege of knowing a little bit is a group called the Rose Circle here in the Rogue Valley, which provides support circles for adolescents, both boys and girls, modeled after the women's circle movements. And the kids are so grateful to have that model and the ability to find that support. Unfortunately, the girls still need support for the same kinds of things. If you look at the clothing that's available for little girls, tiny girls, I mean, my little baby granddaughter was given a bikini with ruffles on it. Excuse me, there's something wrong with this. Rap artists, we were talking yesterday with a group, and they were telling me about a rap artist who has a song out that recommends rape, and he's being offered a reality show on television. I mean, we've still got huge problems that are the same.
Let's take another call. We have Sandy in Mount Shasta on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Kathy Olson, the author of Take Me to Mercy.
Yes, good morning, Kathy. I'm delighted that you're back on our local wonderful Jefferson Exchange. I heard you when you were here speaking about your mother's book, and I got the chance to talk to you and tell you how much her story I stand here ironing meant to me. And this book sounds wonderful. I'm going to have to get a copy as soon as possible. I think what you're doing is great because you're right. Kids don't have much of a context. Young people don't have much of a context for remembering how much worse things were. And again, they're not all that much better now. And I'm particularly concerned about the effect this sort of cultural ignorance has on children. And I appreciate you bringing up the fact that so many women and children are in poverty. I'm one of those who think that we're not going to really make much progress in this country until we get at least 50% of all positions of power and authority occupied by women.
All right. Thanks for that, Sandy. Very much appreciate the call.
Thank you, Sandy. I remember you from a year ago also, so thank you. That was good.
We have an email here from Brian in Ashland. He says, "Hiya, Kathy. I read the book and loved it. I envy your memory for the details of those trailing years of the 60s revolution. My comment is on the point of view of a guy, me, who wants to make sure a few men take a look at it. I'd hate to see the book pigeonholed as being for women only. I saw a fair amount of fun in it, plenty of youngsters with naive dreams and the inevitable awakenings that follow. The story just happens to be built around a specific struggle of the time. Now, I'll admit I'm not an objective reader because my mom was a woman, my wife is a woman, and my daughter is a woman. My granddaughter most likely will become one." This from Brian in Ashland.
Thank you, Brian.
He brings up an interesting point, though. When we talk about the activism of the 60s and 70s, did a lot of things get accomplished? I think the answer from you now is not entirely. Did Did people just get other things to do? Did they start raising families and drift away from activism? I mean, what has become of activism in your perception? I mean, where is it? Who is it?
Oh, I think there's marvelous things happening right now. I am of good cheer, and I am of good hope. Look at what just happened in the Rogue Valley with our election. When we passed the anti-GMO thing and we passed the levy for our beloved libraries, nobody thought we could do that. Nobody thought that. Now, who did that? It wasn't just a bunch of gray-haired old farts like me. It was young people who are passionate and eager. I look at what's happening in the world of consciousness about the environment and the foods that we eat and the care of even animals on the planet. These were things we didn't even talk about when I was in those days, back in the 60s and 70s. I remember in the 60s actually being told quite specifically that don't talk about the environment, that's distracting us from the real problems. We've made big progress, and it's mostly pushback from the young. I think certainly every generation has its sort of moments, and I was privileged to be part of a big moment.
And it's well captured in the book, Take Me to Mercy, How the Carrie Nation Changed My Life, a fictionalized account. But the Carrie Nation really was the name of the group that that Kathy Olsen belonged to in Red. And Kathy, thanks so much for joining us once again on the Jefferson Exchange. Good to have you.